How'd you get all this gear?
Yeah, look, I mean, I used to play music, and basically, you know, as you grow older, you have less time to do things like play music. All your friends that play music get married and have families. So the way you adjust, also as you grow older, you have more money, but no time. So you adjust by buying gear and telling yourself you're going to be playing music at some point.
Yeah.
So this has just been sort of accumulating slowly, slowly. And now I have stuff, which is...
That's cool.
Yeah.
Are we going to ever hear you play guitar?
You know, I'm not a guitarist. I'm a drummer.
Wait, but...
I have a guitar.
But you know how to play it, right?
I mean, you know, guitar... to play guitar well, classical guitar is a skill, but to play like crappy rock music is no skill at all.
Oh, it's really easy to do
that. Yeah. It's pretty easy. I mean, I'm bad. And I'm, you know, so I would never ever play, in front of anyone, but, but one, you know, it's, that's that story. So hold on, Shadi. Did you say you like were off Twitter for a few days this week?
Yeah, so Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and most of Tuesday, and even like since then, I've just been tweeting a couple times a day.
Is it a terrible thing to say as a friend that I didn't notice?
Oh my god, that really hurts, Demir.
Right, right. No, I mean, well, whatever. I mean, that's my.
Well, to be fair, I also noticed that you weren't tweeting much, but maybe that's just your normal like lack of tweeting.
I think it's a little bit more of that than that. But anyway, how come you've been off Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, look, so. I don't like Twitter after any kind of tragic, horrific event. So whether it's a terrorist attack or a mass shooting, and so after the two mass shootings that we had this past weekend in El Paso and Dayton, I had a sense that the rhetoric and the competing narratives, all of that would be toxic. And I didn't want to see that, and I just wasn't ready to really deal with it. Also, you know, it's also a very sad event, so it's just hard to even deal with these questions in the first place. But then to add on top of it, the dumb commentary that you get from right, left, and in between, and everyone, and it's almost predictable. Like you almost sort of knew what people were going to say right after these mass shootings. And I also knew that I wouldn't agree with my own side. So, you know, and by that, I mean, I wouldn't agree with most of the folks on the center left, Democrats, liberals, and so on. And I just didn't want to deal with that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter's weird, right? It's especially at times like these, it ends up being a, especially, you know, commentators whose job it is to comment, it somehow also becomes some kind of almost venting slash support mechanism for them.
Yeah.
Like it's confessional and there's a need to say some sort of uncomfortable truths and then get affirmation from the in-group, which, yeah, I agree. It leads to a kind of, it's suffocating after some event where, again, you know, the commenters feel like they need to chime in and it is usually ill-considered and almost designed to get affirmation somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there's always this urge after a big news event that you'll tweet something that will be very timely and that you want it to get like a lot of retweets and you want people to be like, oh, good tweet. And you feel like, you know, you're being useful or saying something useful. And it just, there's something unhealthy about that dynamic where you're almost sort of thinking to yourself, even if somewhat subconsciously, what is the thing that I can tweet at a particular moment that will gain the most attention, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But when I say that I felt like I would disagree with folks on my side of the aisle. I mean, as you know, I think, and again, something we've been talking about for a while, I don't view white nationalism or right-wing populism the way that a lot of folks on the center left or perhaps also just the left more generally do. And my not positive expectations about what some of the commentary would be about basically demonizing. So The problem is when you say like white nationalism is the threat and you have to treat white nationalism the way we treated Islamic extremism, that sounds nice. And that's the sort of thing that people were tweeting right away. And I remember the people were tweeting the same thing and writing about it in articles. This isn't just about Twitter. It's about the general mainstream narrative. After the Christchurch shootings in New Zealand in March, there was a similar thing like, oh, we need to have a war on terror, but this time against white nationalists. And this unwillingness to differentiate between different kinds of folks on the right. What is a white nationalist? I think, unfortunately, for a lot of people in the kind of resistance, white nationalists are pretty much Trump voters or Trump supporters. I mean, anyone who is willing to go along with what they consider to be a, and I think that there's an argument to be made that Trump himself has various white nationalist sympathies and all that. So then if you voted for Trump, then you are basically an enabler of white nationalism. So after domestic terrorism or a mass shooting that targets minorities, then you're going to have this discourse of all white nationalists basically have blood on their hands. That's the kind of rhetoric that you saw. But then what that's scary to me in a way, because for a lot of these commentators, a lot of people on the right are potentially or actually white nationalists. So are you pretty much, in effect, are you criminalizing a whole section of the country? Are you saying that they are all, in some sense, responsible directly or indirectly for the climate of hatred that leads to mass shootings? That's the direction that I saw people going in. And that, to me, is the start of a very dangerous narrative.
Yeah. No, for sure. Look, now help me out, because you're right. I haven't actually been on Twitter much. And you're also right that it's not just Twitter. And I would argue, though, that we didn't necessarily have this kind of quick reaction commentary happening in, not pre-social media press. I mean, it seemed to be the necessary lags led to a more sort of considered thing. And blogging already became, before we had Twitter and the rest of it, was more emotionally charged and sort of immediate. And the goal was to be out as quickly. But it seems to me, again, I've stayed away from most of the coverage as a result. Even the sort of legacy media coverage of the two shootings. How did the commentariat end up squaring the apparent fact that the Dayton guy, seems to have been somewhat on the left, right, or did I get that wrong? And it seems like he had actual declared mental illnesses, and then the other shooter clearly had an ideological bent to it. Or I mean, am I misrepresenting that?
Well, I think first of all, there's more of a focus in the legacy media on the first shooting, and that was the first one. Also, more people were killed. There seemed to me a more explicit ideological orientation, so that makes it, I think, easier for people to kind of analyze, where I think there's still some confusion over the Dayton shooter. I mean, I haven't followed the details, like the background of that shooter and gone into it. I have seen some discussion of him being at an Antifa rally or him having some kind of more kind of this ideological ambivalence that may include some sympathies to Antifa, which would be on the left, the far left, I suppose. But it's also hard to know, because I feel like there have been times in the past where if there is a shooter or a violent actor who has sympathies on the left side of the spectrum, that's uncomfortable for a lot of people. So it just doesn't get discussed. And that's not some kind of nefarious thing. It's just that there's no easy narrative for people to latch on to.
Right, right.
And I think that distorts the coverage in some sense. Again, like it perhaps it's too early to really say too much about what motivated the Dayton shooter. I'm not someone who wants to like jump into that conversation and come to certain conclusions about that. But I did notice this kind of like, this doesn't necessarily fit into a predetermined narrative, right?
Right.
So,
how do you then think about you, since you studied a lot about radicalization, you know, in the Middle Eastern context and the rise of ISIS and the rest of this? How do you think about radicalization? And let me sort of lay out what I'm getting at. It's always struck me that you have people that go off and kill, right? And on some level, whether it's clinical mental illness or a set of circumstances that puts a person to that, and the process of radicalization, however you want to talk about that, perhaps facilitates putting someone in that mindset. But it's deeply antisocial. Something's broken. Not necessarily, I'm not trying to draw some sort of psychological line of what is insanity versus what's, but something is broken inside a person to be driven to do something like that, right? Or is that not a good way to think about radicalization? And do you see that there's a sort of strict defining line between people who are mentally ill versus people who are perfectly sound and have just been radicalized by ideas? Can you pick that apart?
So, from my perspective, and as an example, having interviewed friends and family of Tunisian foreign fighters who joined ISIS, and this came up in a number of conversations I had, was the individual level factors matter a lot, because, and that might almost be too obvious in the sense that let's say you take two people in a particular town or village in a certain part of Tunisia, right? They're part of the same environment on the social or community level, and some of the same stressors are there in terms of like economic factors, unemployment, underemployment, kind of being angry about what was going on in Syria, which is how a lot of this got attention initially in Tunisia. People were outraged about what the Assad regime was doing. And, but then you have to explain, why does one person, so let's say they're even like brothers or close friends. One decides to go travel and fight for ISIS and the other stays put, but they might otherwise have similar ideological or political orientations. So clearly the person who decided to go, something happened there that kind of pushed that person over the edge to make that decision. And, what I found in my interviews was that, not always, but there does tend to be like a life event that stays with someone that, and they're not quite the same afterwards. There could be some trauma or someone in their life, they lose someone in their life, or they're going through a very difficult time. That's not enough on its own, but it is a contributing factor that has to be brought into the conversation, right? And that's why talking about how specific individuals radicalize and trying to understand the stories of individuals becomes really important. That said, there's a limit to how far you can go with that, because every individual story is a little bit different. And I do recall I won't say who it is, because I'm worried about kind of, misquoting her. But maybe it's fine to say. I think Jessica Stern, who's an expert on radicalization, she had a very good line in one of her books. And I remember it again, this is not an exact quote, but something along the lines of, radicalization is a bit like love, that it's very personal and it's very hard to measure and understand in an empirically systematic way, because it's about the intangibles and what these emotional currents that are going on in people, and it's interacting with other variables, and it's very, very personal, right? So that's why, we have to understand the individual stories, but I think what's more helpful, like from a policy standpoint or for us as analysts or observers, is to look at what makes radicalization more or less likely, all other things being equal, because you can never interfere in people's personal lives and stop them at just the right moment. But what we can do is talk about the societal level factors that policymakers do have influence on, right?
Yeah, right. So, it's interesting you talk about especially foreign fighters, right? And some are you know, convinced to go fight. I was thinking, as you were talking, the extent to which, you know, when you enroll in the army, the whole process of boot camp also is to, you know, get you sort of motivated to a certain extent to be able to actually go fight in a war. And I imagine there's a parallel there too, where the role of, well, call it indoctrination or ideology, or sort of getting a person to the headspace of saying, well, you know, I'm willing to sacrifice my life and go actually fight. I mean, I think the act of going to war, of committing to going to war, to a certain extent is actually a very profound sort of, again, as I was getting at earlier, sort of a break with socialization. You know, you and I, as supposedly reasonably well-balanced individuals, we're not likely to go do something like that because, I don't know, you know, I mean, it would require an incredible leap for me to act in such an antisocial way, to actually go take a life, you know? And it's so what is then, because I think this is what people get at when they talk about radicalization, is the role of ideas, and they focus on that, right? And the role of ideology to the exclusion of all the other factors that you said. So they try and latch onto ideology as the one thing that maybe we can control, right? But and is that helpful?
Yeah, but ideology is actually like somewhat difficult to control. Like it, ideas are there in the public discussion. I mean, if a war against an ideology is, first of all, rather broad. I mean, if the war is against white nationalism, there are tens of millions of Americans who sympathize with some aspects of what folks might consider. That doesn't mean they're white nationalists, but there are aspects of the white nationalist mindset that they might be sympathetic to, right? So then we get into how are we, like, what does it mean to fight against an ideology that has inroads into a broad cross-section of society, you know? But I think, Demir, one thing that you're getting at, I think, is really important, which is the socialization aspect, in the sense that, let's say, you know, and we talked about the pre-modern era last time as well, as a kind of, and this is maybe an oversimplification, but in the pre-modern era, when you went to war as part of a collective. That wasn't a product of a lack of socialization. So the impetus for violence is always there. It's a question of, is it channeled in particular ways? Is it regulated by the legitimate conduct of war or battle? I think what we're seeing now is that impetus towards violence or towards anger is going to be there as a constant throughout human, you know, human history. But what we have now is a kind of more individualist culture where people, and this doesn't just apply to the US, but also to the Middle East, people are better educated. They have more access to information on their own. They grow up in a context where choice is everything. So they're making choices about what they believe and what they want to be angry about. So that can apply to a Tunisian as well. They have more, in a sense, freedom to kind of go in these different directions and then to be exposed to different intellectual interlocutors who could be quite extreme. And they're like, oh, they're latching on to particular ideas, where in a more pre-modern regulated environment where the individual isn't paramount, it's hard to see that same process happening in the same way because the socialization and the social constraints are overwhelming. Mm. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. Here's the question. Is there a difference in your research or in what you've read in general between, say, people in Tunisia who go join as foreign fighters versus, let's say, you know, young Muslim men in Europe who are radicalized to go, you know, drive a truck through a crowd, or, you know, do a bomb attack, or, you know, or so is there any qualitative difference between that? Because, you know, what you're talking about, the sort of belonging to a whole versus the individuation. Again, I'm far from an expert in this, but I've read things that talk about the fact of, you know, the individuals in Western societies, maybe first generation immigrants or maybe second generation immigrants, they feel the sort of disconnect from the society they're found in, and they're then grasping for things to orient them within the Western society, to some sort of tradition, which then, you know, through the internet, perhaps they find a certain kind of strand of ideology which compels them to do violence. Whereas, is it different in the Middle East, someone joining to fight and go fight in a foreign war, where it's more of a sense of, I belong to this community and I'm joining an army or some sort of fight? So in a sense, are foreign fighters in that context more socialized versus the sort of lone, you know, alienated attacker? And, you know, to me, the reason I ask this is because it helps me maybe think through how should we be thinking of, you know, these unfortunate young men who are reacting and acting through a bunch of stuff here in the States.
Well, I do think networks matter. So, but that would apply, I think, to some extent in both Europe and in Tunisia. So chances are, if you are a foreign fighter from a Muslim minority community in Europe, you can kind of like stake it out on your own. But, you know, oftentimes there are networks and people are introduced to these ideas by other folks in a certain community. And that's certainly what happens in Tunisia, is that you might hear about someone else who went to go, fight in Syria, and that kind of puts the idea, it makes the idea plausible. Because until you hear about someone else going, or until you know about someone else going personally, it's still mostly a theoretical thing, right? So I think that kind of network effect is important. But when a Tunisian is joining, say, it doesn't have to be ISIS necessarily. We're also Tunisians who joined Jabhat al-Nusra, another Al-Qaeda affiliate, another extremist organization. That is more, they're still in a sense joining a group, right? Which to me is different than a mass shooter who's fundamentally from start to finish acting alone. And there isn't really any collective aspect. I mean, maybe there are communities online, but ultimately, this is a lone shooter who's acting in a very kind of singular way. So I think there are differences there, but what the common trend, I think, is a sense of dislocation. And people might ask, well, why would Tunisians feel dislocation? It's maybe more understandable in Europe because of the kind of cultural disconnect in some of these Muslim minority communities. But in Tunisia, you have an interesting, you have these relevant factors of a country that doesn't really know what it is or what it's going to become, because it experienced forced secularization for several decades under Ben Ali and Bourguiba. And then the revolution of 2011 introduces this newfound freedom, and people are trying to figure out what it means to be Tunisian. And there's a stark ideological divide between Islamists and secularists and like everything in between. And then you have ultra-conservative Salafis who are for the first time preaching. And that introduces a kind of uncertainty where Tunisia didn't have a kind of a pedigree or a history of organized Islamic expression. So oftentimes people were finding out about different Islamic currents just on their own, because the Muslim Brotherhood equivalent in Tunisia and Nahda was pretty much destroyed in the 1990s and 2000s. So they didn't really have a presence in everyday life. And which is quite different than, say, a country like Egypt, where even though you had repression under Mubarak, there were still these strong communities of Islamic action or Islamic intellectual orientation that were there even during authoritarianism. So that's one factor that I think plays a role in the case of Tunisia. But again, like, you know, this is not a science, and there's a lot of disagreements among people who look at this stuff. And I think we're going to have a lot of the same disagreements when we're talking about the fight against white nationalism. And a lot of it's going to be impressionistic, and a lot of it's going to be about what side of the partisan divide you're on, and whether you're sort of I don't want another war on terrorism. I don't want another forever war. I mean, that's not a great thing. So when people say, well, oh, well, we should, you know, we have to learn from, you know, the war on terrorism in the Middle East. But let's just remember that that wasn't necessarily the most successful interlude. I mean, the last 18 years since 9/11, I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff that happened in the name of the war on terrorism. And some of that includes restricting civil liberties. And I sent you this article that I was reading just before I got here about how there's now a debate about, do we have too much freedom of speech? This is in the New York Times. Yeah, yeah. And there's now, should we have, an approach to freedom of speech and expression that's more akin to what we have in Europe, where there are actually qualifications about how far freedom of speech can go? That stuff freaks me out.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I just to sort of back up a little bit on this, right, is that, yes, that always seems to come up. I mean, to me, reading that article in New York Times reminds me a little bit of the futility, I think, of, and maybe we're getting smarter about this and how we debate, and maybe these shootings are going to change things. But the extent to which, given the Bill of Rights and given how entrenched these rights are, I feel like that these are almost cries in the wilderness, you know, these like, well, free speech restrictions and things like that. What I think, though, however, is likely, and again, let me just, again, back up a little bit and say that I totally agree with you. I mean, I did pop onto Twitter to mock a little bit this idea that we're going to have a global war on domestic terrorism. That, I mean,
So you got a sense of it too.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I mean, and it's a preposterous idea. What are we talking about? Regime change?
So when you saw that, like, what was your reaction? How did you feel when you were seeing this commentary? Were you surprised? You're like, this is like the same bullshit that you normally expect.
Honestly, what hit me on it was what I started by saying. I had this feeling that people needed comfort and they're just venting, you know? So I tweeted some, kind of very dismissive stuff and kind of felt bad. Like right after I did it, I was like, okay, whatever. These are nerdy commentators trying to find comfort in something and find certainty in action. Like we can do something to stop this. I mean, to a certain extent, I get it, right? I get the feeling that you feel helpless and you want to do something about it. And I share your worries about, you know, the directions where this goes. Ultimately, on freedom of speech and I hate to say it, you know, also on guns, I don't think there's going to be that much movement on any of that. It's too entrenched in our things. But where it could, you know, one of the lessons, if you will, or call it one of the maybe not properly learned lessons, but or maybe not talked about enough learned lessons from the global war on terror, is that a lot of this heavy-handed stuff doesn't work. But more troublingly, I think what can work and has been tried and done in the United States throughout history is actually more kind of, like state surveillance and things like that of groups trying to track this sort of stuff. I mean, you think about what, the FBI was doing in the 50s and 60s and there's a precedent for this and, again, I think the barriers to these things already under Bush have been eroded because of the global war on terror about what can be done domestically. And I think it's society's antibodies to that kind of overreach that I think are getting worn down. So I think if we find out that there have been abuses of domestic surveillance, I think you will have potentially less pushback from Americans than you did after, you know, the sort of details of Bush's.
Yeah, and certainly less from the left. I mean, I think you'd have outrage on the right.
Well, depends, I think.
Or no?
Well, depends who's president. I really do think there's a lot of that's
what a lot of this depends on. But certainly, like, you would think that the left under Bush was, and I think this was a good thing about Democrats and liberals and folks on the left is that they were saying, hey, let's not forget about civil liberties. Let's stand up for this. And the ACLU played a very important role at a time when there was a lot of fear and a lot of people were like, hey, and the polling, I think, made this pretty clear. A lot of Americans were cool after 9/11 with giving up some degree of personal freedoms in the name of this war on terror. And now I think that the left, because now it's in a different position, would probably would support, or some sections of the left would support or justify similar things done against the other side in the name of a kind of domestic war on terrorism. So that, but even if heavy-handed government actions work, and I would put work in quotation marks, there are also second and third order effects that we can't always anticipate. And this is always a danger of having significant government interventions in regards to things we don't really understand that well. We can't, I mean, there could be other, it could work in the short term, but provoke other, you know, other problems. And I also think that when we're trying to understand terrorism, domestic or foreign or whatever, so whether it's a white nationalist terrorist or, you know, a Muslim extremist terrorist in the Middle East, the goal of a terrorist is to compel the target government or the target population to do things they otherwise wouldn't do. It's meant to provoke overreactions that that sort of punctuate the equilibrium. It's meant to create disequilibrium in society. So I actually support pretty strong restrictions on guns, and I might actually be like somewhat outside of the mainstream on that. But at the same time, I'd worry that if you have, like, let's say you have Australia-style restrictive gun laws, which I'd generally be open to a discussion on, I do worry about the kind of polarization in a country like ours that that would provoke. And I think that's in part what some of these, what right-wing fanatical types kind of want. They want the government to overreach. So that puts, like, so I'm torn on some of these things, because I think we need pretty serious gun laws, but I also can't anticipate what that would mean. In Australia, there's more, I think, public openness to pretty restrictive gun laws. I don't know, considering our history and our constitution, and you know, I just don't know what that would mean in the American context. Also, and I think that when people say, well, the reason that the El Paso shooting or the other shootings happened because we're very permissive on gun accessibility, I'm also thinking to myself, well, we've been permissive for a very long time. So if you're saying that there's an uptick in mass shootings and that's because of gun accessibility, there's a kind of empirical problem there, because you know, and I think this is where political science becomes helpful. So if access to guns is held constant as a variable, that it's pretty easy, then that can't be the explanation for why there's an uptick, because it doesn't make sense in terms of the variables, right?
Sure, but I mean, I'll give you the answer that would be du jour. Obviously, that it's not guns qua guns, but it's white nationalism that's doing it. It's this ideology that's driving
people to
more violence.
So which one is it then? Violence. So then it's not guns then?
Well, no, sure. I mean, but as we said, right, the consensus now obviously is, well, we should regulate guns to make it harder for these politically unacceptable ideas to, you know, wreak havoc on our societies, but also the root cause is this sort of idea thing. But let's talk about the idea thing, because I think that's really important. First, you're absolutely right to note, and I think it's a really important point, that the whole point of these, you know, crazy online communities like, you know, 8chan that just got shut down this week,
yeah.
4chan community, all these sorts of weird places that are completely anonymous, and you have these people posting, there's seems to be a culture of egging people on to do it and to, you know, like, yeah, take the leap, do it. It's this sort of gleeful nihilism that permeates the whole thing. But the other big idea is just that. It's all a lie, you know, and we can expose the lie by basically encouraging a kind of overreach in society. So
yeah.
There's a logic there that's totally pushing that. However, interesting to me is, you know, you started this conversation talking about how you're uncomfortable about how, you know, quote you, your side, you know, on the left is sort of approaching this and the sort of unease that gives you. I really feel like what we're going through right now is is a kind of, I mean, it's something that happens in the United States periodically. It's a kind of moral panic of sorts that's driving a lot of the way we talk about and think about these things. And there's almost a kind of, I don't know how to put it, like displaced religious feeling. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to.
Demir, this is shatty bait right here.
I am doing a podcast with you. I'm trying to bait you. That's part of the goal here.
Oh my God, it's like my favorite topic.
I know. So look, let me sort of round out that idea. It's more than just religion. It's that for the left, I would argue that the kind of, you know, what normally is just sort of, I don't know how conscious it is among the faithful, but it's particularly a subconscious thing among the left because they are so professedly secularized by and large. So their piety and moralism about these things is not seen as a set of, you know, organizing beliefs, but it's seen as a pure truth. So it leads to a kind of like extra zeal among the left. Whereas I think, you know, again, a more socialized believer who understands that belief doesn't make it any less true, but I feel like less at war with the outside world than this kind of mentality of a secularized left that sees, you know, its set of values and beliefs as the absolute truth, and anything that goes against this as not just, you know, in disagreement with, but fundamentally, you know, wrong, morally wrong. And they're blind to the moral element of their belief system, I guess. Does that make sense, what I'm getting at?
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think this moral panic is part of, is in some sense part of who we are as Americans, that we like to feel moral panic. But then again, maybe everyone likes to feel moral panic. I think it is somewhat universal because I like feeling it too. And I, you know, I think that to the extent that we're aware of it, we try to check it, you know, maybe we sometimes indulge in reverse moral panic, where in our bid to be contrarian and to fight what we see as an overzealous left purity wokeness, that we almost do like a mirror image of that. And we have to be careful about that, I think, on our own part. But I'm someone, you know, as someone who works on the role of religion in public life, I mean, I'm very much a believer, if you will, in the pervasiveness of belief, that it's very hard to find people who don't believe in something or people who don't want to believe in something. And I think it's granted there are exceptions to this. And, you know, I don't know, Demir, like maybe you're an exception.
Maybe.
But I think most people throughout human history until the present day, there has to be some coherent belief system that organizes their life or organizes their interactions with their fellow citizens. And that's so even with the most secular reaches of the left, I think that's why we're seeing, and I think you put it this way, displaced religion, because we have experienced the decline or loss of Christianity. That doesn't mean that the impulse towards certainty is gone. It just means that it has to find expression in other ways. And I think that wokeness is an example of that, that it gives people certainty. There's purity, there's atonement. I think we talked a little bit about this last week on the podcast. So all these things, or maybe we didn't. Maybe we talked about
it. What other podcasts are you on, Shadi?
Or maybe we just talked about it when we were hanging out sometime.
Yeah.
Okay, so this, like, the language of atonement, of sin, and I see this so much, and maybe that's why I think we might have talked about it last week, this idea of America being a sinful nation and having to atone for its badness. This is all kind of religious rhetoric in the service of secular ends, right? So that's one thing I would say. And I think there's also something potentially more, it can sometimes be, in a sense, even more messianic or more or more uncompromising, because secular religion can't wait until the afterlife. It has to kind of claim its victories in this world, because this world is all it has. Now, granted, religious people don't necessarily act this way in real life, but at least in theory, there's a strain of religious thought in Christianity, Islam, Christianity and Islam in particular, and maybe to some extent in Judaism, although I'm not as familiar with some of those, so maybe I could be missing something there. But this idea that, hey, this life is inherently imperfect, we are broken by sin, the only true and final judgment is from God, and that will only come in the day of judgment after we pass, so on and so forth, which does allow at least some practitioners of various faiths to say, hey, we might want some things in this world, but if we don't get them, then that's also not the end of the world. That's okay. And we can wait and we can defer judgment or postpone judgment until the next life, right? And this is something that I've been thinking a lot about, and I've been, you know, doing dialogues with Christian friends, you know, evangelicals and Catholics, but it's definitely there in terms of this idea of being broken by sin and that perfection is not possible until the return of Christ. So you do have these things that you can find in Christianity that lend themselves, I think, to a non-maximalist view of what is possible through, say, public policy, where I don't necessarily sense that even the pretense of humility with some of my interlocutors on the left. There isn't even a pretense. And you might say, well, Christians, would be the criticism that, oh, Christian evangelicals or Protestants or whatever, they're pretending and they're using this rhetoric, but they want to impose in this world just as much as anyone else. Maybe, fine, that could be true for a lot of people, but at least there's the pretense. What happens when on the left you don't even have, you're not even pretending to have any epistemological humility?
You know what it is? It's we hit on it a little bit last time. That last book by Peter Berger that again, you know, talks about he did a lot of research with evangelicals with very literalist beliefs who nevertheless, you know, we're able to sort of compartmentalize those and sort of live a modern existence without actually even questioning a relatively literalist interpretation of the Bible, which they took to be a core segment of their beliefs. And even if one were to sit down and, you know, play some game of gotcha and say, well, these don't match up, in lived existence, this caused no problems for them. In a sense, though there was a contradiction there, they lived a kind of political existence in America that worked, perhaps. I guess what I'm getting at on the left, you're alluding to this a little bit as well. People jump down your throat if you say this, but there's a kind of extremism to it in the sense that it's because they're blind to the fact that you know, they are in fact ensconced in a set of beliefs. And they're never forced to maybe even square a belief set with, well, put it this way, a liberal tradition that is the core of America. I would say that a certain sort of, and a growing subset of, you know, yeah, the woke left, don't recognize that they are behaving in what are outwardly easily defined as kind of extreme ideological ways, and they don't see that these spheres are anything. It's basically a kind of purity dogma that they're espousing. It's like they're swimming in ideology and they don't know it.
Yes.
Now, obviously, look. I mean, how do I put it? Everyone, to a certain extent, has a set of beliefs, as you said, that, you know, they actually take to be true. But it's interesting, you know, part of the reading that I've been doing sort of on the side that's in no way related to this, I've been reading about the Yugoslav communist Milovan Djilas, who got run out of the party by Tito in the 50s, and reading the book I just finished is his conversations with Stalin.
Oh yeah, is that what you've been tweeting about?
I've been tweeting a lot about that. It's a great book. We'll talk about that some other time. But what's interesting about it is both at the same time how ideologized everything is the way he talks. But at the same time, he is not unaware of the fact that his is one ideology among many. And I mean, part of the drama of the book is, him coming to terms with the fact that Soviet communism is different from Yugoslav communism and the role of, Soviet imperial ambitions and politically how that's playing out. But it's also, even any references he makes to the West and, the capitalist order, it's dismissive, but there's a recognition of a kind of, relativism, that these are separate spheres of values, which you don't exactly hear, I would say. There's a kind of absolutism to the left's moralizing about these issues. This is evil. These people are evil because they hold these beliefs. They're dangerous because they have guns and they go on shooting rampages. And as we were saying earlier, I question whether ideology in and of itself is enough. I mean, I think it takes a certain kind of leap to do that kind of horrific violence, though ideology clearly plays a role. But to me, what's troubling is that the left is so sure of itself in a way that it's so non. For all the sense that it comes out of this postmodernist moment of relativism and a deep tradition of supposed critique, it is deeply unselfcritical and deeply unable to situate itself in the world in a way that allows it to both make sense of the world, and to actually participate in a pluralist democracy, I would argue.
Thoughts? And this is why, any reference to evil suggests a certain kind of Christian way of looking at the world, but just in a different form. And I don't know if, and that's the thing people don't realize, the idea of evil is fundamentally religious.
Right.
Evil doesn't, at least from my standpoint, and maybe there's some debate in literature about this, but once you start talking about evil, you're talking about God. And where you can't really situate where evil is independent of where God is. But putting that aside for a second, I do think that you're getting at something really important, which is that woke progressives, they have no tradition that constrains them that is external to them. Yep. It's a sort of internal self. It's a self-referential belief system that has no end and no limit, where at least what you have with, let's say, Christianity or other religions, Islam, others, Judaism, is you have, again, you may not have this in practice, but you certainly have it in theory, which is fixed tenets upon which you can judge what people do and why they're doing it and if they should be doing it. And it can be held at least somewhat constant, at least some of the foundational elements of it, right? With woke progressivism, there are, as far as I can tell, no fixed tenets of the faith. It's an endlessly progressive faith. It's always aspiring to something new, and it's always eating its children, or whatever that phrase might be. Religion is not meant to be that way. Religion is, at least mainstream religious traditions and the ones I'm more familiar with, which are the Abrahamic traditions, there is a kind of inherently small Sikh conservative tradition in each of these religions that does impose constraints upon practitioners. Now, the practitioners might not choose to observe those constraints, and if they can choose to be radical and go outside of the classical tradition of these faiths, but at least that conservative constraint is at least there in some sense, right? That to me is a fundamental difference, and that's why I think that non-religion masquerading as religion, or maybe that's not even the right way to put it, but wokeness, religion masquerading as wokeness, or maybe it's vice versa, who knows anymore, that to me, it holds out the potential of being more dangerous because it follows no small c conservative tradition. There's nothing that will say this is constant. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. I mean, I in the sense that I was equating it to religion, I recognize now that you say it, that's precisely why it's wrong to say that. It's a kind of extremism, really. It's in the sense of there's nothing inherently extremist about religion per se, though there are religious extremists. There's something extreme about this in the same way that religious extremists are extreme because they are unable to, well, again, quite frankly, socialize. I guess that's what I keep sort of coming back to as I think through this with you. It's what's, and this is not to equate, you know, mass shooters with, you know, with wokeness. I'm not even going there. That's not what I'm getting at. But I am getting at that there's something happening. And maybe it's happening because there's a lack of glue in our societies that is tying things together, a lack of meaning, perhaps, you know, and it's expressing itself on the one hand by individuals, lonely individuals, atomized people living on the internet, finding meaning and being driven to extreme acts through some mix of, you know, personal circumstance and ideology. And on the other hand, there's a kind of other phenomenon that's not actively violent and necessarily leading to the kind of outrages as these, but that is nevertheless very toxic, is not conducive to a healthy Republican attitude, to a healthy Democratic approach to things, and that there's a similar lack that's driving both. I don't know. Maybe that's oversimplifying.
Yeah. So tell me more. So tell me a little bit more about the lack of meaning part of it.
Again, since I've been doing a lot of reading about the, you know, pre-Cold War, or that's not the Cold War period. What's striking is the extent to which, insofar, we're already well into the sort of secularized moment in Western culture, in Western tradition. Secularism's, you know, dominant, less so maybe in America, but certainly in Europe. But you have an existential fight that presents all sorts of meanings and valences. What's striking to me as I read, and this is not just reading these communists and their memoirs, but also you read histories and accounts of the mid-20th century. The liberalism that drives sort of American self-conception and American drive to, you know, win or, you know, prevail or survive in the Cold War, it somehow feels more resonant and meaningful because the threat is real, and it's the ideas are argued somehow, I think, with a sense of more belief. Communism falls apart. The left is left without any kind of, I think, legitimating set of ideas, any sort of framework anymore. And even liberalism on the right, or I don't know, it's not fair to say that liberalism on the right, like liberalism's on the American, but say, you know, the Cold War right plus sort of Cold War liberals, in general then default to this kind of chestless neoliberal meliorism, which is, well, you know, end of history, here we go, we figured it out, technocratic this, that, and the other. We're headed to just boundless prosperity, and it's just a couple of tweaks left and the world gets solved. Neither is very satisfying. The left has no answer, and they sort of parrot a maybe more social democratic version of this. And on the right, you know, it's largely godless. It's technocratic. It's nothing. So it seems to me like on the one hand, you have on the right a growing sense of a sense that this is empty, that the individualism that liberalism used to champion against the kind of godless communitarian communist alternative has led to all sorts of dead ends. And we have we've built a society that provides no meaning, no sustenance to communities, and it's an empty existence where all we're doing is just trying to do better and get rich, and our lives are empty. And on the left, you have not that kind of despair, but a kind of regression to, again, a kind of extremism, which is doesn't recognize its own sort of how it's just not self-critical at all. So it has a kind of sense of revealed truth that, you know, if you're woke, you get it, and it's true, and everything is false. So it's a kind of ideological extremism and rigidity that. And I would argue that both of those are kind of reactions to a kind of lack of satisfaction, intellectual, spiritual, broader satisfaction with a meaning of life sort of thing.
Well, so one thing is that there's no moderate wing in the woke church.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that's part of it here, you know.
Can there be one?
There can't. At least I don't know if there can be, because I think that would just sort of defeat the purpose of wokeness, which requires a kind of ideological outbidding. But like your bigger point, and I'm glad I asked you to elaborate, because I think this is really interesting to me. And I think like I'm working it out now as I'm talking, is I think there's a mismatch between the desire to believe in something strongly and the lack of strong things to believe in. On the other hand, like, we want to find things. We want an ideology. We want to believe. We want to return to some like religion or something like it. But then what we often end up, you know, what we often end up with is something that isn't particularly inspiring or isn't even particularly ideological. So in the case of, we were talking last week about the National Conservatism Conference. That's an attempt to outline a kind of new intellectual orientation that can actually speak to the moment that we're in. But when you actually look at what the policy prescriptions are, there isn't actually a lot there. Like, we're reaching for something, we're groping for something, but what we actually end up with is kind of mainstream. Like, no one, with maybe one or two exceptions at the National Conservatism Conference, the ideas might be bold and radical, but then when you try to translate that into policy terms, they're always going to be underwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, I'd go even further too. I mean, it's I was saying last week, I still believe it. It's a reaction. It's not a positive program. Now, you know, I mean, to be most fair to that, it's to say that, sure, the positive program doesn't get expression in that, because someone like Patrick Deneen is a believer and has a religious tradition that lies in the back of his criticism. So all he's showing is a kind of, you know, reactionary criticism with the rest of it sort of assumed. But you're right that I don't think anything I saw at the National Conservatism Conference has any real answers to the reality of America as it is today. It's a kind of, if you're uncharitable, you know, reactionary spasm. If you're more charitable, an ongoing critique that assumes a kind of communitarian Christianity as the default. But I don't think either of those, or I just don't think it's actually all that useful to lived existence. I mean, I like a good critique, so I'm sympathetic.
Well, so maybe this is part of it then. Like, we don't actually have the courage of our convictions. I don't have the courage of my convictions, in the sense that so I wrote that that article in American Affairs where I tried to outline what a left populism could look like, and one that really embraced what I called an economics of meaning. This idea that you can use strong economic and class critiques to essentially fill the ideological vacuum and to move away from identity politics and wokeness, and to ground the left in a strong ideological, economic, you know. So, but the issue here, and the weakness perhaps in my own argument, is one of the reasons I'm comfortable with an economics of meaning, a kind of like Bernie, not socialism, because that's not actually what I think Bernie is offering, but a kind of a strong left populism that is also maybe in some sense an inclusive populism, and that is not, you know, casting corporations out and maybe like super rich people, but it's not like casting minorities out, and therefore it offers maybe a tamer approach to populism. One reason that I'm comfortable with that, I think, is because I know that the American system, because we have a two-party system and we have a first-past-the-post system, it won't actually allow for the fullest expression of left populism. So I can rest assured that there will be a kind of equilibrium regardless. Because do I really want to live in like the fullest expression of that? Probably not. And one of the reasons I don't want to is because, like, when push comes to shove, as much as I'm critical of liberalism, and whether it's the classical or partisan varieties of it, or like to the extent that I'm sympathetic to post-liberal writers and I engage with their work a lot and I find their work to be very important, the Patrick Deneens, the Why Liberalism Failed, all of this stuff, what I often end up coming back to is, I think this is pretty good. Like, in the broader sweep of human history...
Well, it's pretty good what we have.
Not necessarily what we have currently, like in this exact moment,
yeah.
But the basic... I don't want a complete alternative to liberalism. I don't want to totally experiment with like Catholic integralism or some different ideological system, because for all of its faults, in broad terms, we've done very, like, this is good.
Yeah.
And when I kind of look at, especially, and here I'm not even talking about like, this could apply to Western democracies writ large, but I particularly mean it about America. The fact that we have these stark ideological divides, but you know what? As terrible as the Trump era could have been, and yes, it's bad in many ways, I come back to the idea that it could have been a lot worse. We're still finding a way to live together. There's a kind of de facto pluralism in American life where it feels very existential, but actually it's not existential in practice. Like, we're still working within the democratic process, and we might be angry at each other, and it might feel like it's on the brink of civil conflict, but you know what? It's not. We haven't reached civil conflict, because there's something about the American system and the American politics that is able to accommodate fairly high levels of polarization. And one of the reasons we can do that is because...
No, look, I here's my question to you. I mean, I share your optimism by and large, because you look around. I think we're way better positioned than the Europeans are in any of this.
Yeah,
way better.
I agree.
How worried are you? I mean, we started this by you saying that you had to get off of, you know, Twitter. Okay. Sure, Twitter, whatever. It's Twitter. But how worried are you about these tendencies about, you know, yeah, I think we can accommodate a level of polarization that is large. But it does, I think, for liberalism to work, and you've written about these things, that you need a certain kind of at least base commitment to these things. And it strikes me that, again, let me make clear, without drawing any sort of exact parallel between the violent far right and the sort of broader woke left, one does get a sense that there is a kind of erosion of something important. And it's tied to a loss of belief in the process and the partiality of liberal solutions, in the sense that it's all part of a certain kind of emergent thing that doesn't come to an end. The ultimate enemy of a kind of healthy liberalism is one side that is certain of itself. Obviously there are these radicalized individuals who are doing violence to try and trigger perhaps overreach, and one can talk about the sociology of why and how this is happening. And maybe one can derive policy prescriptions about levels of surveillance and or, you know, interdiction and or ways to tackle that. But again, I would suggest that there's something deeper and perhaps troublingly ill at play here. So there's my pushback.
Yeah. I think that as you get older, or maybe this is not actually true because a lot of the people who are like obsessing on Twitter are like older people. There isn't necessarily an obvious age.
But I'll tell you, Shadi, I'm older than you. I'll tell you what it's like as you get older.
there's a part of me that wants to I want to live my life in a particular way and not live it in outrage or in anger or in frustration. And I want to value the things that I think, I want to prioritize the things that I value more, which are friends, family, meaning. I want to have my own time on my weekends where I'm not checking Twitter all the time. And I want to be able to let go. I want to make space for other things in my life. Anyway, that's a little.
But I'll say, you know, I obviously I share that. I've said it many a times. I've quit most of the social media stuff. Twitter, I feel, is a professional necessity, and maybe that's what a heroin addict says. It's like I need to do this for work or something. Yes. But whatever.
What heroin addicts are known for saying.
They are. I need to shoot up because my work requires it. I absolutely agree on that. But you know, it maybe gestures at some of the other themes that we've been talking about. And maybe we can sort of wrap on this, but it's that a lot of the social media stuff, it provides that kind of cheap kick. We started talking about the fact that so many people at the moment of these tragedies jump into it with these overheated hot takes, and they end up looking for affirmation to sort of salve their empty souls. Right.
Yes.
And it's the more time. And so, social media to a certain extent is a part of the nexus of the causes of a lot of these bad things, I think, that are eroding our ability to function as a normal democracy, that's leading to a kind of polarization that's not the normal polarization. That's not the normal sort of, let's not overstate things. We did have a civil war in this country. Polarization, you know, doesn't need social media to get to the point
of massive organized
violence where we're at each
other's
throats.
One could actually make the opposite argument that social media can provide a peaceful outlet for otherwise like dangerous impulses, that because people can like talk all this shit all the time and be angry on social media, they don't have to do it. Like, they don't have to like organize a militia and like fight the North or the South or whatever. That's also one way of looking at it.
I've heard that. Right. And I mean, arguably, to the extent that even in the 60s, you know, you had way more political violence, arguably, than we're having today. You know, these horrific mass shootings aside.
The domestic terrorism in the 60s. Yeah,
it was a very different sort of thing. So again, that said, I think I just want to latch onto what you said about, you know, on a very personal level about social media. And maybe it's because, you know, like the heroin addicts we are, we justify it that we have to be on it for some sort of reason. I personally really loathe it. I really loathe it. I try and go there and have some fun, but then I get sucked into some nonsense. I find myself stopping myself from intervening. And, you know, there's that famous internet cartoon, right? Like, someone on the internet is wrong. It's like, honey, come back to bed. It's like, I can't. Someone on the internet is wrong. And and it is that feeling. It is that feeling that I think it may not be, again, polarization, extreme violence, all these dysfunctions, you know, may not have anything to do with social media, but I increasingly see it as an unpleasant and toxic force that I need to unplug from and not engage in. It's not good. It's not healthy. It has its positives, but it's in my own personal experience, I am making an effort to just carve out time, as you were saying, not just on weekends, just, you know, just dead time off of this.
Well, to your point about there can be some positives to social media as well, I've been seeing this undercurrent with some, because I follow like maybe kind of like a weird crowd, and I mean weird in a positive sense, that I've seen a couple friends and people I respect talk about the desecularization of America, that we might be entering a phase where by 2050, we actually see a reversion to higher levels of religious observance and kind of at least self-reported belief. I don't know. I haven't actually looked at this very closely, but we also in trying to not get too stuck in the moment that we're in, to have a broader look, and that this is just a moment. Things pass, things change. It's hard to sort of forecast some of these trends.
But what social media does is it unfortunately, I think that is one thing I feel reasonably comfortable in saying, it compresses time and it makes everything about the present.
Yes.
And it makes everything about gratification of our emotional needs in the very immediate. It impacts writing in that way. It impacts writing because you do your first draft on Twitter and then maybe you write an essay. So it pollutes the downstream writing as well, because you've already been validated in one way and then you're expounding again for this sort of validation thing. It narrows horizons. It greases the wheels of a certain kind of communication, but degrades it. So you know, I mean, did your colleagues or your social media scene that's talking about this desecularization, they link it to social media somehow, that it's leading to a religious uptick, or this is?
I don't think that social media plays a role in that, but maybe it does in a kind of counterintuitive way, that because social, maybe for some people, that because social media is so unpleasant, and it actually kind of, it brings out to the fore our sense of our lack of meaning, that something isn't quite right, that in some indirect way it can push us back to a deeper sense of belonging or community or religious commitment or whatever it might be for an individual person. But
yeah, I could see that actually. I could see that social media, insofar as it takes a kind of, you know, hyper individualism and then sharpens it to,
and you're like, do I want hyper individualism?
Yeah, right.
And
right.
I think that maybe some people, after spending a lot of time on social media, are like, hey, we do not want this. But but also that, like, we have no fucking idea what's going to happen in 2050. Like, that's it. It seems so far away in social media terms, because as you said, the present seems like everything when you are getting in some debate on social media. And it can be hard to kind of maintain our sense of like, there is a broader sweep that we're part of. And we have to sort of separate ourselves from the moment. And that's what I find very helpful about unplugging, is that it allows us to think a little bit more about, like, what might America actually look like in 2050? And it seems plausible to me that there could be some, I don't want to say religious awakening, because that's probably overstating it, but, you know, a kind of stabilization of religious commitment or a desire for religious belonging in the sense of like the communal aspect of it. It might not even be in the sense of actually like theological conviction as much of communal aspects of religion that I think people find appealing. And, you know, maybe Marianne Williamson is a sort of an example of a spiritualist kind of expression of that desire for belonging, right? But maybe that's almost extending it too much to go beyond religion.
Yeah. Look, I feel like Marianne Williamson's a quintessentially American phenomenon, and in a way, like, you know, almost eternal, kind of like Trump ultimately, right? But without going down that rabbit hole, the interesting thing for me, as someone, you know, I'm you know, very much raised secular, and I think, you know, religiosity to a certain extent is something that is part of your upbringing. But I tend to think also certain people are more I guess keen or receptive to that sort of worldview. For me, pulling back from social media, just as an anecdote, I went and reinstated my membership in my alma mater's library, and I've been going to the library more, where I turn off social media. It's quiet, and I read books that are actually on paper. It's a weird thing.
And you read them in the library, or you bring them back home?
I mean, one can do that in libraries. Yes, it's true.
Demir, please explain to us how a library functions.
Exactly. No, look. So, yeah. Maybe this leads to a kind of desecularization. But I'm hoping that maybe my hopes are less grandiose. I just hope that it, as people drift away from this, they re-engage with the importance of time and space to think and reflect. I think that's been the biggest casualty of social media at this point. And maybe that's the role of religion that religion plays for you know, more religiously inclined people. For me, it's time to not jump to things, to talk or to think or to just engage on a slower pace, because it feels that a lot of these ills that we're constantly talking about are tied to this kind of quickening, this kind of coarsening that is the result of modernity, I guess. I guess that's where I'm.
Well, I think that's part of what religion is actually meant to do. Maybe again, in theory, not necessarily in practice all the time. But when you think about the idea of the Sabbath and kind of carving out this space where you will, in fact, try to reflect. You'll be separated from the temporal world, and you will try to the extent that you can to block that out. Or the idea of praying five times a day in Islam, where you have five times a day where you focus on God and you separate yourself. There are corollaries in Christianity. I'm trying to think of whatever the equivalent of that is.
Well, here, Shai.
Trying to be ecumenical to me.
Here, let me be ecumenical. I would hope that something like this podcast is the equivalent of carving out some time to hang out with friends and discuss and talk about things on a different pace. And honestly, this is so far a pretty fun experiment.
No, that's what I like so much. Like, I was looking forward to coming here to your living room, Demir, and actually just like hanging out and talking about this stuff.
Yeah, hopefully our listeners feel the same way. In any case, let's do it again.